Come and raise me. Order, and we're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 5022. And our great staff, Steve Bender, can lead off, kind of explain the model and how it works. And we'll go from there.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I am Steve Bender, Legislative Fiscal Office. And today's agenda will be a discussion of the new budget model and how that works. And as Chair mentioned, I'll be starting off with just a short introduction to the model. And then, as you see on your agenda before you, there will be a number of people from the Oregon University system to discuss the new model as well. What I have done is provided two handouts, and I'm going to just be really going through this one here, which says Higher Education New Budget Model Elements. So if you could please find that, that is what I'll be going through. I've also distributed another sheet, which I will not be going through, but has some information as well on the Oregon University System new budget model. The main reason I'm not going through this sheet is both in the interest of time, and also the dollar amount on here refer to the Senate budget level. That's to say the level that the Senate funding that the Senate president proposed back before the session started for the institution. But the rest of this presentation today will just be talking about the new budget model itself and where a funding level is involved, it would be in reference to the governor's recommended level of funding. But I'd just like to go over what this new budget model is and how it works and what some of the ideas behind it are. If you look at the first page of this handout, new budget model elements, there are some fundamental elements or concepts in the new budget model that are different from the way higher ed is operating now. The main thing is that campus funding, the amount of money that campuses get, will become more directly related to their enrollment levels than it is currently. So campus funding will be tied very much more so to their enrollment levels than before. And there are a number of reasons why this is happening. Under the new budget model, campuses will retain the tuition revenues that they generate. This is a change from what's going on now, or what has been going on, where almost the vast majority of tuition revenues are shared. That's to say, the system at a agency level combines the tuition revenues and the general fund, and then distributes that, the combined monies, to the seven campuses. That's the way the current system works. Under the new system, that no longer happens. So a dollar tuition that's collected at, say, Western or any of the other seven campuses stays with that campus. It doesn't go into a pool that is shared. There's a very significant portion of tuition that even currently, under the current system, is not shared. And as exception to the general pooling rule that we have now, and that is the undergraduate tuitions that are collected by the University of Oregon. Under current arrangements, 90% of those are already retained on the University of Oregon campus, and 10% are shared with the remaining non-resident. 10% is shared with the remaining tuitions and the resident tuitions. But this new model would move all of those dollars and all of the other dollars for the campus tuitions and have the campuses retain them. Furthermore, more of the state support dollars, that's to say general fund dollars, will be distributed on a per student basis than is now the case. State support dollars are distributed now, obviously, between the campuses, but they'll be more directly related to per student as opposed to other factors. The next item speaks about enrollment corridors. The new model eliminates an existing practice, which is to create an enrollment corridor. What an enrollment corridor is to back up for a minute. even under the existing model, institutions' funding does depend upon the number of students that are enrolled there. This isn't entirely new, but it's not as dependent. And one of the factors or reasons why it's not as dependent is that each institution is given a target enrollment. And if their actual enrollment falls within a certain amount above or below that, their funding level is held constant. So if a school gets some more students than their target or fewer students than their target, their funding is held constant. It's only when there are large differences from what the projection had been, that's to say when you move outside this corridor, either above or below, that the funding level has changed. But the new model eliminates that. So even if there is one more student than projected, there's more money available. If there's one less student than projected, there's less money available. So this is another factor that's making the campus's funding more directly related to their enrollment level. The fourth item on that first bullet, under that first bullet, existing support for most non-enrollment costs is eliminated. What I mean there is under the existing model, an institution or campus receives specific funding for things such as building maintenance. So if a campus has a particular physical plant that has more expensive maintenance costs than average or has one that has less expensive maintenance costs than average, that is currently considered in their distribution of funds. This specific support is being eliminated, and that again makes the campus's funds more directly related on how many students they attract. The next element of the new budget model is that the state support per student will vary by the program type. That's to say whether you're in math, whether you're talking about a math class or an engineering class or a history class, and also by the level, which is whether we're talking about the first 2 years of undergraduate study or the second 2 years.
If I could just interrupt you for a minute, to go back to the building costs, building maintenance, where would they get the resources? Would those resources have to come from the tuition?
Those resources would come from the funds that they get from their tuition and the state support for students. So it would be basically based upon the revenues that they generate by attracting students.
So they're not going to come to the state and say we need more money to fix our campuses and build more buildings.
No, they're not expected to.
Okay, thank you.
That's not true. Okay, just along that line, then, once the market begins to drive people, some institutions are not located very favorably to within a range where there are lots of students, and others are located in a better range. What happens when some systems are full to the brink and others are empty, that they, or not empty, but at least substantially decreased? What do they do in that instance?
We will see that the system has adopted certain measures to protect campuses that have lower than anticipated enrollment. So the things that we're saying here, the elements, these aren't entirely pure. They've been adjusted some, and we'll go through that later on.
They've been thinking about this, the fact that facilities are limited and can only handle so many people, and also that some facilities can handle more and can take more students. That's been considered.
And in terms of the building of new facilities, that process is not changed under this new budget model from the existing process. It's the operating budget that's changed. So if new facilities are needed, they would continue to be go through a process where they would be proposed, the chancellor's office would review them, and then they would finally come to either the legislature or the emergency board for approval and funding. This concept of state support per student varying by program type is also not entirely new. Under the current system, the support that institutions or campuses receive does depend upon your program mix. And those campuses that have more expensive programs, such as concentrations in, say, engineering, which are expensive, or pharmacy or other types of expensive programs, do receive more money per student than those that have programs that are less expensive to operate. And in fact, in this case, in this respect, the new system is simplifying the variation, not in terms of the extent of the variation, but in the categories of how the amount is determined. If you flip ahead to the second page here, I made a copy of an old document. These numbers are not current anymore. These are the numbers that were developed when the model was originally being developed last summer. But they give you some idea as to how these funding levels will vary. If you look at the first two columns where it says state revenue per FTE, all what this page is looking at is undergraduate programs. There's another page, there's another table for graduate programs, for master's levels, for doctoral levels. But what you can see is that most programs, academic programs, fall into those first three rows of numbers. So there are the least expensive programs to operate. If you look at the second column there, you could see what types of programs we're talking about, liberal arts, English language and literature, et cetera. For those particular programs, the model would provide state funding in the range of $2,900 for each full-time equivalent student at the freshman and sophomore levels, $3,800 for junior and senior. Then there's a second group or a middle group where the programs include education, business management, computing and information sciences, and those other ones that you see there, where the funding is higher, and the rate there of $3,700 per student for the lower division and $4,800 per student for the upper division. The funds that an institution would receive would be these funds plus the tuition revenues, which would be on top of these.
Yes, just a clarification. CDC is referring to per student in the FTE.
It's not being specific enough. It is per student counted on, the dollar terms are on a full-time equivalent basis. So the way that it would actually work is an institution would report how many credit hours it is offering in English language and literature at a freshman or sophomore level, and that would be divided by the number of credit hours that are needed for to represent a full year, and they would receive $2,900 for each of those. One student could be, you know, a physical person could be taking classes in, you know, many of these categories at the same during the same term. But the highest cost disciplines would be of the major three categories are shown there: the agricultural, the engineering, and the visual and performing arts. And then there are separate categories above that for pharmacy, and there are also additional funding for engineering technology, which doesn't show directly here in this model. But this is the basic concept of how this model works.
How are we going to do that when we're budgeting and anticipating, you know, a couple years in advance in biennium and not knowing what those numbers will be in each institution? How will we be able to get the money to them when they have the students on the scene? Does the money follow the students in every case, or are we basing this on some model or some year before and what their enrollment had been? How does it work?
I think it would be best, Senator, for OUS to discuss that. But basically, it's a system that is not based on RANDs, but requires adjustments during the course of the year as better data.
We will have the flexibility to make
that. But the idea is to, as much as possible, reflect the current enrollment and not to look at a last year enrollment or 2 year ago enrollment.
Representative Ross?
Madam Chair, just to follow up on that question. So at the beginning of the year, they have estimated their student load, and they'll be receive money for that, and then sometime during the year, they'll receive an adjustment. What's the cash flow like here?
Perhaps, if you don't mind,
okay.
Perhaps defer that.
Okay. Thanks.
the, just going back here to this handout here, getting through this first page, the new model makes the funding of particular activities clearer and more explicit. That's to say, it specifically indicates the type of funding that is being applied for tuition waivers for to support smaller campuses, the additional costs incurred by smaller campuses, not on a per student basis because they don't have as many students to spread out the certain costs, fixed costs. The next to the last item is that under the new model, distinctions between base and other enrollments are eliminated. I think this needs a little bit of explanation. Base enrollment is defined to be the enrollment in classes that are offered in the regular term, that's to say not during the summer, but during the fall to spring term, and basically they're the ones that are often on campus at the regular time, or fairly typical time. Everything else, other enrollments, which I called here, which is also called extended enrollments, are summer school classes, off-campus type of classes, classes that are offered at unusual times. Under the current model, the funds that the state provide are distributed based on to the campuses based on their enrollments in the base core enrollment only. So to the extent that a campus is offering other classes at summer or at these other times in an extended framework, the institution does not receive specific state funding for those enrollments, and indeed the institution's budget internally, and these types of courses are generally maybe referred to as self-support in the sense that the tuitions are set for these courses in a different manner than for the base courses, and the tuitions are expected to generate enough funds to support certain direct costs of those classes, most notably the instructional cost, the cost of hiring the instructor for that class. Is generated completely from the tuition for those classes. This model eliminates that distinction and provides or distributes state funding based on the total enrollment and makes no distinction between the two. The impact of this is, if you start looking at what the impact varies by campus. Some campuses have far more than the average of their enrollment in these extended types of enrollment. For example, statewide, about 12% of all the funded enrollment under this model will be in the extended or the non-traditional time classes. But some institutions like Eastern has about 24% of their enrollment there. TSU has about 20% of their enrollment there. So the fact that the model will distribute funds based on the full enrollment instead of just the base is especially helpful to these types of institutions. Other institutions are below the 12% average. Both OSU and OIT have about 7% of their total funded enrollment in extended enrollment. So as the funding is spread out to cover the full amount of enrollment, these institutions receive less relative to their peers in the process of expanding that. But what we're looking at here is the way of distributing whatever state funds are provided among the seven campuses. And this is changing the way that those funds are distributed. If there are no questions, I'll just go ahead to page 2 here.
Are you going to get to the way of graduate students?
Oh, I'm sorry. Graduate students in some respects are treated the same and in some respects are treated differently. In a respect in which they are treated the same is that there are similar numbers for graduate students. And in fact, OUS in their blue book here, which is a source document, I think the top item there should be a chart that looks like this. First page is a much nicer version of what you were looking at here in my handout. And the second page goes on to the graduate level. You can see that the graduate level also is basically segregated into three program levels. The funding amounts are much higher for FTE. And in that sense, they're the same. In other sense, there are some differences. And the differences are the following. For the undergraduate programs, these state funding amounts are typically or almost exclusively provided only for Oregon undergraduates, Oregon residents. When a non-resident student is enrolled, this amount of money is not distributed. So the general funds are not distributed in support of that student, but the institution, the campus, still gets to keep the non-resident tuition, which is generally so much higher that the campus doesn't financially suffer by not having the state support on it. But the state support tracks Oregon students at the undergraduate level. The exception is at Eastern Oregon University, where both resident and non-resident students are counted. Continues a policy that's been in effect to have an equal tuition at Eastern for resident and non-resident students. And this continues the funding because the non-residents aren't paying any higher amounts. For the graduate program, especially at the doctoral level, the funding is provided for both resident and non-resident students. The distinction isn't made there. Graduate programs in general attract from a much broader market, and the system has made the decision to fund all graduate students with the state dollars that you see there in addition to the tuition rate.
Master's as well as doctorate?
I'm sorry?
Master's students as well as doctorate students?
Master's students are generally, the general rule of thumb for master's students is that the dollars that you see here are again provided only for the Oregon students, the Oregon residents, but there is reduced support dollars available for non-resident. I think $1,000 per student for the non-resident. So there is some state support dollars for the non-residents at the master's level, but not at the level for the Oregon residents. So it's sort of a mix between the way doctoral and the undergrad.
Will there be incentive for students to forego the master's and just get in a doctoral program?
The incentive, so you're talking about a non-resident, the student, this will be, for as far as the student's concerned, the student would just face the tuition. This would not be transparent to the student. I think the question of whether the institution itself would want to...
Would you like to come up and join to address that? Get your name for the record.
For the record, my name is Bill Angelo, and I'm with the Oregon University System. And the chancellor asked me not to do this, but I guess I did it anyway. There is a to answer Senator Cho's question, there is a threshold of credit hours at the graduate level that distinguish the PhD from the master's, so that there would be no advantage of trying to change the program, because the way the funds are going to the campus are determined by a per credit hour threshold.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to speed up what I'm going to so it doesn't take up too much of the time for the people from the university system who are here to testify to you. But the second page here talks about the principles. What is behind these changes? And I think the principle is fairly easy to state. And the idea, the principle is that the campuses and the whole system can be made more entrepreneurial, can function in a more entrepreneurial fashion, and be more responsive to the needs of students and people who employ their students if the amount of financial, if there's a financial incentive for campuses to retain their students, to be able to attract students and retain students. To the extent that you can increase that financial incentive, the institutions will respond and develop and be more cognizant of being able to get programs that are good enough to attract students and retain students. And the way that this does this is by financially rewarding campuses if they are successful in increasing their enrollment. They get the benefits right away. They get to keep the extra tuition. They get more state support for students. Under the old system, if a campus was able to start a new program and get additional students, generally they would get no additional revenues to meet those costs, at least for the first couple years. And this provided this incentive. I mean, to go out, it's expensive to do that, and you don't get any money for doing that. Under the new system, it would be different. If you go out and you can attract more students, you get more money pretty much right away to do that. On the other hand, if you're not successful and you start losing students, it hits you right away. You don't have the stability that was in the old system. The finances page, for time purposes, I'm really not going to go over that except to say that the original request for the model funded with these dollar amounts that we were talking about here for students was for $116 million. And the governor is proposing $76 million above both of these figures are above CSL, and has designated that some of these dollars have to be used for specific purposes. $15.3 million is going to be used to freeze the instruction fee for Oregon undergraduates for 2 years. It's important to note that this $15.3 million is not new resources to the system. This is simply replacing tuition monies that they would get without this freeze. So of the new monies that are to the system, you would have to take the $15 million off the $76 million total. And then there's some other specific designations that the governor makes. The governor envisions a two-biennium phase in of the new model. On page four,
Representative.
And I know we haven't gotten to that number, but just assuming that's what we appropriate this session, we're actually modeling 44.7. So the next biennium would be what? What kind of phase? I'm a little numbers you're looking at. The difference between 116 and 24.
It would presumably be at the 116 level adjusted for some type of adjustment for it.
Okay. So this is the first step. This would be a down payment. And next time.
So Representative Edwards, I have not seen a particular number, and I'm somewhat speculating here.
We'll ask those. Okay.
I'm sure. If we did phase in the model over two biennia, would it cost roughly the same amount or proportional amount of the budget for the model each time? So if we're spending $45 million for it this time in 2 years, would it cost another $45 million to phase it in?
There are a number of policy issues involved, really, before you can answer a question like that. I think what the university system would probably do would be to base their request on their projected enrollment plus some inflation factors for the per-student funding. There are policy issues in that in the past, the legislature has not funded OUS not adjusted their state support based on the number of students they have. So I think these are policy issues that need to be worked out in order to determine what the second phase of this phase would be.
Well, let me ask a question generally. You're an economist. Is phasing it in cost effective, or is it better? Would it be more cost effective to put it in place one time immediately?
In terms of cost effective and saving money, I don't think there would be. I can't see where you would particularly save money by phasing it in over a two biennium period as opposed to one biennium period. I think it's more of an available revenue issue as opposed to some type of an efficiency of doing this over a longer period of time.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Some time ago, I was talking with President Frohnmayer about the entrance requirements to a fine school like the University of Oregon, and he told me that students that had the grades I had in high school would just not qualify these days. That's probably good. But the question I have is, who sets the entrance requirements at each institution? You know,
those are approved by the state board.
higher. Okay, because my thought was that if you wanted to increase the opportunity to enlarge enrollment, instead of having, I think, 275 or something like that, three.
You're going to get covered.
Great, most of them at college. Sounds like a darn fine way to decrease enrollment.
Since you were there in the way of coalition.
No question. No more of that social promotion stuff.
Excellent.
But that would be a way to expand opportunities for people to get into at least four-year institutions instead of having a requirement of three. And I would submit that somebody who has a 2.5 or a 2.25 is not exactly lacking some degree of intelligence and might actually make it someday if given the opportunity to get in.
And Madam Chair, are you implying that you have made it?
No, I'm just suggesting that there are those tonight.
Thank you. Back to the more mundane about how much this costs. Down the line, we're going to need some kind of way to compare the overall costs and the immediate and delayed costs on the different approaches here. And one of the things that I haven't heard mentioned is if we fund the whole thing now at the $100 or $116 million level, then we have roll-up costs next time. And so at some time, we're going to need some comparison of what the $100 million cost us this time and next time and what the governor's proposed $44 million would cost us. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Representative Winter?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just a point of clarification. Would you take me back to the $15.3 million freeze? And you had mentioned that it's not new resources. What does it replace?
What it does is, under the current service level budget, it excludes the $15.3 million, the undergraduate instruction fee, which is most of the tuition for Oregon residents, would increase by 5.25% each of the 2 years of the biennium. This would retain the split between tuition and general fund that we had this biennium. It would necessitate that increase in these tuitions. What the $15.3 million would do under the governor's budget is keep tuition, keep the instruction fee for the Oregon undergraduates at the current rate, and then use the $15.3 million to replace the additional money that would have been collected if it had increased by 5.25% each of those 2 years. All other tuition fees, by the way, that's to say for non-residents, and for graduate students, both resident and non-resident, on average are increasing by 5.25% each year under this budget.
Senator Nelson?
Thank you. Under the governor's proposed budget of the 44.7, it's my understanding that the higher education system does not feel that's adequate, particularly with respect to, say, like small schools in my district, like Eastern or OIT, or I think they're either Southern. That the percentage is such that it really causes them some detriment, and that there is a difference between what the governor is proposing as his budget model and, say, what Senator President is proposing for his. And could you comment on that?
Yes, Senator, there are differences, and what higher ed has done is, in response to the funding levels that the governor has approved, they've actually gone back to their model and made some changes to accommodate implementing it at a lower level of funding than was planned when the model was being developed. And the way that they have adjusted that, basically, if you look on page 4 of this handout, starts to talk about what they did. One of the things that they did was they prorated and reduced all of these cell numbers in order to meet the available funding. And they reduced them to about 91% of the numbers you see there for the first year of the biennium and to about 93% for the second year. This is including the inflationary adjustment. So it's a little different than the numbers you may, people in this room may be used to hearing. But another thing that was done was that the number of enrollments that will be funded has been limited. under the original plan, the concept is every time the campus gets a new student, they get more state support. But under this proposal, only a certain number of additional students would be funded. And if the total in the system increased by more than about 840 or so students over the course of the 2 years of the biennium, there would be no additional state support provided. The institutions would just receive the additional tuition from those students, but not get additional state support.
We had a meeting last week, and it seemed to me that there was a pretty significant difference between the funding level that the governor had and the funding level at, say, $70 or $80 million for actually for the budget model. And do you feel that that takes, what you're saying, takes care of that, or is that a, to me, that was a pretty major area of concern, talking with Dr. Creighton from Eastern, and he felt that it was funded at this lower level that would be significantly more difficult for him in a smaller university to take care of that.
Senator, I do. Clearly, there a number of institutions are more at risk under this model. That would include Eastern, that would include OIT, and to a lesser extent, Southern. These, another thing that higher ed has done in response to this is they put in minimum funding increases, essentially guaranteed to all campus funding floors. And the floor was calculated to be, I think it's 2.2% in the first year above the base expenditures that are estimated for that campus. As additional funds are put in, this funding floor is increased. So some of the smaller campuses receive more funds than they would.
Thank you.
President Steve Reno is here speaking for the smaller solutions, and you'll have a chance to visit with him later this morning.
Thank you. Madam Chair. Senator Gordon.
Thank you very much. And good morning, Mr. Bender. In addition to institutions possibly being at risk under this new budget model, and again, considering the information that we have here on page 4, I'm looking at the bullet that talks about the 705 additional FTE funded in high-tech and teacher education programs. And could you say more about what might be at risk under this model in terms of programs like the teacher education program, and where we face some critical shortages. What you follow my line of?
I think so, Senator. At the level of funding in the governor's budget, again, there is limited total funding for increases from the current totals of enrollment system-wide. But for particular programs that are especially in high demand, including teacher engineer education programs, engineering-related technology, computer science, and some graduate engineering programs, the system will provide, be more generous in funding additional students or student growth in these areas, and will essentially target additional funds into growth in these particular program areas.
So then the model will allow us to reduce the number of high tech and teachers that
increase.
We need.
Yes.
It will.
Yes.
That's what I'm looking for.
Yes.
Thank you.
The number of the enrollments in those programs. Yes. Page 5 shows under the governor's funding level the impact on the bottom line for campuses. What I've shown here is the percent increase that the campuses will have in the biennium over their base expenditures. And you can see there's variation there in the percentages. I didn't put the actual dollar amounts. I have those information if you want those as well. The state funds per tuition, that's to say the amount from these tables plus the tuition dollars for FTE, this shows what the impacts are on how the campuses would be funded under this model, under the governor's level.
Madam Chair. Just so I understand this particular chart, is this percent over the base, is that a percent over last year's allocation, or is it a percent over last year's allocation plus current service level?
It's base. It's similar in concept to the current service level, but not exactly that. So it's the amount over what their it's not over last year, but it does include changes in cost from the current biennium to.
So loosely, this would be the percentage they would receive above current
loosely. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Steve, you mentioned you could actually break out costs or totals per institution. Can you do that? Can you give us that?
Sure.
And again, this is the phased in. Is this, I keep getting confused, is this the 44.7 million? And that's the equivalent to the 116 that it's OSU came up with?
No, it's less. I mean, they're dealing here with the total amount of money that the governor is recommending. So this is the governor's recommended budget amount and how the campus
right.
is fare under that.
So obviously we would assume if 116 and then you'd see
it would be
higher increases
yeah.
in Andrew Senate and House Republican leadership
model. Yeah.
And, could you just help us out and understand the, there's quite a variation in the percentages from 10.5 to 4.3. Could you explain the 10.5 and the 4.3 and what those mean and why the percentage increases at grade or lower?
There are numerous factors involved for each campus, and in some cases these questions could probably be better addressed by when you have the campus president there or when you have OUS. But
it's
things such
it's
as
part of the formula, isn't it?
Right.
It's
yes, it is.
Part of the formula.
And part of it depends upon projected enrollment growth for the institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it depends upon the extent to which these institutions have extended enrollments and the fact that funding is now being applied to the extended enrollments. That helps.
What does that mean?
Well, this is that these are, again, the courses that are offered outside of the standard time.
I see. And so those
that's
are being
example,
funded now.
That, for example, is a major reason why TSU has a higher number than average, because they've got a lot of those courses.
Extended.
Yeah. And other institutions.
Wait, can I just interrupt you a minute? Senator Gordon?
Yes, this is in line with Senator Trow's question. It would be very helpful to have more information about the assumptions behind each one of these campus projections. We don't know what those assumptions are. You're alluding to them, but in order to have more comfort with the projections, I need to know what the assumptions are.
And these, Senator, are all projections. They're just that. They're based on the projected enrollment for these institutions by the types of disciplines that they're offering. And, of course, you know, that could change. And finally, I won't go over the last page in the interest of time. It does indicate some of the risks that are involved in the model as well.
Any other questions? Thank you. Mr. Fox, would you like to next?
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Joel Cox, Chancellor of the University System. And again, in the interest of time, because I really want to get you into the mechanics of the model and hear from the several presidents who have come some distance to be here, I would just make several points. Each day, we're going to give you a blue cover follow-up to questions that you asked us the previous day. I think it'll perhaps make it easier for you to keep track. Secondly, I just want to cover very quickly.
What was that?
You have an echo.
Yeah. Not blue.
I always do like that.
That's exactly. We all do look like that.
Senator Miller reminds me when I turned my PhD in, the dragon who ran the graduate school University of Maryland. Said, wait a moment. He went back and got my freshman scores. He came back and said, well, there's another one. We shouldn't have admitted. Today, we're going to talk with you about the resource allocation model. And then in the outline you have, you can see the what happens the rest of the period. We're going to take you down through the quality and access issues, turn to partnerships and preparation for life and work. And then we have a rearranged Monday, as you now know, with public testimony in the morning and the cost effectiveness issues in the afternoon. We'll look at the audits with you and walk through those. Tuesday, we'll focus on employability, a healthy economy. Wednesday, we'll present the base budget and Thursday, your work session. And each day, we'll show you a check mark and decide what days have preceded, us, and so that way, we'll be able to track. What I'd like to do, Chairman, is with the committee's indulgence and President Bernstein, is that we're going to change the agenda slightly today and move directly into a discussion of the model itself, the mechanics and the principles and the assumptions, because I think that will help get at some of the of the understandings that you're seeking. And joining me is Bill Angelo, who's Vice Chancellor for Finance Administration, probably the person who has been the most significant creative force behind this, working with his counterparts on the campus. He'll be joined in a bit by Nancy Goldschmidt and a few others, and then we're going to come back and have you meet the president. But we thought, by putting the model out first, we'll get some of your questions quickly answered. Bill?
Thank you, Chancellor. I think Steve covered quite a bit of the principles and involvement, but I did want to make some additional points, I think. This has been, intensive work in the last year.
Bill, can I get you that? I take your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is, for the record, my name is Bill Angelo. I'm with the Oregon University System in the Chancellor's Office. Sorry, Chairman. The sense, and I think we've covered some of this these charts in yesterday's presentation, but this has been an effort that's been going on since 1993. It isn't something that we invented in the last 8 months or so. But much of the heavy work has come in the last, since 97, with the issue of the SB 919, with the development of performance indicators, which Nancy Goldschmidt's going to...
Which piece of paper are we working from?
I'm sorry. If you would look at the charts 5 in your book, which book? Representative Ross.
In this one, under the tab that says resource allocation model.
Thank you.
All right. We're trying to... just reflect on some of the things that we talked about yesterday and try to do that at a pretty good clip, if we could. Slide 5 introduces sort of in a timeline the redesign of the major systems. You heard from the former board president and the board president yesterday in the redesign of governance and structure. Most of my involvement has been in the area of budget and finance, a committee on budget and finance has worked with the president and with the campus staff and with the chancellor for the last 8 to 12 months actually designing the model that Steve presented a moment ago. I'd like to turn to slide 6 if I could to perhaps remind the committee what we heard as the state leadership request to overcome impediments to access, to develop a student funding model where the tuition follows the student, where it's a reasonably transparent process, where you can see exactly where support is going to be directed, and that it provides some level of incentives for market-based response to demands of Oregon industry and the Oregon citizens. Going on to slide 7, an effort to move to swift decisions on program availability, to create some kind of benchmark process, to develop a performance funding component of this, and incentives for collaboration. Not to remind the panel,
Senate Bill 919 required the OUS board and the campuses to develop performance measures to tie proficiency-based admissions to K-12 reform, to expand early college options, expand access using technology to increase internships, and to maximize transfer between community colleges and others. Again, this model is but one small piece of trying to accomplish that in terms of ways of providing revenues to campuses so that they can get on with these particular tasks. This next chart on slide 9 deals with perceptions. It isn't necessarily a true line for line. You heard a little bit about this in Steve's presentation, but I would argue that the formula that was in place and the mechanisms by which the formula was received allocations under the so-called old system was essentially a cost-driven kind of an approach. For instance, if a campus was able to successfully get a new building, there was an element in that formula that allowed for the fuel for that building, the building maintenance costs went into the formula, independent of how the building was used. In this new approach, in terms of research and public service programs, as well as instruction, the concept is that you want to see results, you want to see students, and therefore the funds will attach to the students, and the funds will arrive at the campus based on the numbers of students and some other factors in terms of the way funds will move. Again, we're trying to focus more on the learner than on the provider. We're trying to develop planning cycles that are strategic rather than driven by this cyclical expenditure cycle. And as Mr. Bender mentioned on several occasions here this morning, we're trying to move to a faster pace where such things as the enrollment corridor and other conditions tended to keep campuses at the status quo because there was risk in taking additional students without immediate reward in terms of the funding in that year. This model attempts to respond to funding requirements when students are attracted to the campus. And in the area of standards, trying to be more comprehensive and focused, and we'll talk about that a bit. The next chart up, number 10, resource allocation model. I won't spend too much time here, but both the campuses and the chancellor's office staff spent considerable time in terms of research across the country in an effort to develop this model. We looked at a series of states, both on the issue of how they dealt with formula funding, how they dealt with performance funding, and other considerations. And we also used some of the current patterns in terms of the Oregon University system in setting some of the targeted programs. So it was done with a fair amount of research and as much care as possible. On slide 11, the board and the board committee developed some guiding principles in response to leadership. And the key for me is that tuition and fees will remain on the campus. Once you decide that, instead of the current model where the funds are pooled, the tuition funds are pooled with the state funds, that's the key consideration, the key breakthrough in terms of whether or not this is going to be a successful kind of model, in my opinion. State funds are allocated primarily on a per-student basis. We've tried to use incentives to stimulate innovation and entrepreneurial activity, and we're trying to develop accountability measures through the performance budgeting aspect. If we could put up slide 12 for a minute, it's just a visual I think that many of the members of the committee have seen previously. It's a sort of description of the resource allocation model. Tuition and fees, all sponsored programs, monies, auxiliary funds, auxiliaries means dormitories and food service operations, gifts and grants, all of that campus-based revenue in the white stays on the campus. In terms of the next two boxes, the state tax fund, the bulk of the allocation will go on a per-student support basis. And Steve has already shown you the essence of how that would be allocated out by graduate students, and PhD students, and by the various levels of funding for standard course programs versus higher and higher, most expensive or most programs needing the most money. What we've done at this point is taking the old model, which had as many as 250 variables to it, and condense that down to a 12 or 14 cell model so that you could see it, you could understand if we were adding students in engineering or we were adding students in education, you could see exactly what kind of state resource would go in for that consideration. So we think it's a much more clear defined kind of program. But then we have a series of targeted programs, if you look on the right-hand side in the yellow. And the first is the statewide public service programs, the Ag Experiment Station, the Extension Service, as well as the Forest Research Lab. Those are very specific appropriations that are made to those programs, and that money flows right from the legislature to the programs without interruption. We also have such state initiatives as the 504 program, SB 504. That's a state initiative for engineering. We are introducing, as I mentioned a moment ago, the concept of performance. And the board spent a considerable amount of time thinking about how that should work and what the elements of it should be. We're starting out in a very small step. About 0.5% of state funds would go to performance in the first biennium. Of the state funds available. There are other states that have taken 20 years to get to about 5 or 6% of their funds directed on a performance basis. Tennessee comes to mind. The other states, there was a, for instance, in South Carolina, I believe, there was an effort to go to 90 or 100% all in 1 year, and it caused a fair amount of chaos. We think that if we start out slowly at about 0.5%, over several bienniums, that could be built up to about 5% of state funds that would reflect very specific kinds of performance.
Can I just add one footnote to what Bill said? That is in addition to the performance features of being enrollment-driven. That is the largest performance reward of all, because if you serve more students, retain more students, more efficiently graduate more students, that's the fundamental driver. This is an additional performance enhancement on top of that to achieve goals and targets set by the board in specific areas.
A clarification from Mr. Bender of the targeted programs, the statewide public services, those are in another bill. Is that correct?
That is correct.
In another committee?
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Yes. The other points I would make that in specialty disciplines, we did fund on top of the level funding that's in the material that you saw, there are special allocations for engineering, graduate students, and engineering-related technologies that exist at OIT as well as at Oregon State. Mr. Bender's already mentioned the master's program. There is $1,000 for non-residents that is specialty funding, and we are also proposing that a portion of these funds be directed to internships, in which there will be enough money to attempt to facilitate additional internships with the private sector. Transition funding. The university system has tried to put into this model first at the $116 million level and also at the governor's level, and would be true at if the Senate level were adopted by the legislature. We have provided for a certain amount of transition funds in order to move over to this new environment, and this would be especially helpful for the small campuses where there is such a there can be such a change in enrollment can have such a dramatic impact if it occurs in a single year. I think some of the discussions inside the university are whether or not that funding floor, whether that or not that minimal is enough to get all campuses to a healthy start. So the question is,
if we're moving into this new direction, do we have all campuses where they need to be to make sure that each one of them can be successful? So sort of a play on head start. The next one is the issue of a base level of support, which is ongoing. Transition suggests that you would do it for a biennium or two, but you also need to consider regional access funds. In the case of OIT and in the case of Eastern Oregon, because of their size and the way that this model was constructed, we thought about an institution that was about 6,000 FTEs. Well, OIT and Eastern are about 2,000 FTEs. So you need to build enough resource in on a targeted program basis under the category we call it regional access or base level of support. And we do the same thing for Western and Southern, where there's enough money to pay for the business office, to pay the president's office, to have a full-size library or a full-size physical education facility, just to make certain that the institution is there. The other, the next item is support for research. There is both a percentage amount of state tax funds that would support the research endeavor. This has a positive impact at Oregon State, at the U of O, and as well as at Portland State, a bigger impact, if you will, but it's available to all. And there's also a percentage of faculty effort that would cross all seven campuses in terms of encouraging faculty to conduct research. Public services programs, there are on a number of campuses very specific public service programs. I think they amount to about $5 million, but some illustrations are the small business development centers at Southern and Eastern, demographic department at Portland State, where there is very specific public service activities that are unrelated to an FTE. So we need a mechanism to make certain that there's adequate state support for that. And then, of course, any board initiatives that would come along. On slide 13, we've seen this a couple of times, but this is just the aggregate levels looking across the chart. One of the things that we've done is actually categorize this by student level, and that's a little bit different approach than the rest of the country, which sort of tracks courses. But the sense of it is at the level one, just for illustration, a liberal arts student that's a freshman, the campus would receive the tuitions for that, the instructional fee and other tuitions, about $3,000, and then $2,900 under this configuration to support that particular student at the freshman level, et cetera, up the line. Mr. Bender's already mentioned in slide 14, more specifically, identifies the students that are to be funded in this program. And following up, I think, Steve, you've covered most of these. The only other ones were there are some reciprocity agreements between Oregon and Washington. There would be funding provided for those students. Our staff to take courses, those would be counted in, even if they lived in Vancouver.
I'm sure. Is it part of being entrepreneurial to try to increase the number of level three students over level one students? Get more money.
We are going to need a constant vigilance on in terms of making certain that the student body and the courses that they're taking are properly recorded. We think that this approach best suits that. But I think what it does, Madam Chair, Senator Trow, is that if there's a need to increase the numbers of students that have graduated from a community college to go into an OUS campus, the funding is distinctive enough at the junior and senior level to provide for an adequate support for that student coming over. In the old model, there wasn't that kind of a sensitivity. So one of the incentives in here is that if the board moves to a policy of increasing the numbers of seamless transfer, if you will, or response to seamless transfer, there would be adequate resource at each campus so that when that student came in at the junior and senior level, to cover the estimated cost of that.
Yeah. It seems to me that we're going to have to be careful to make sure that we try to recruit all students and that campuses don't really vie, especially for the students that bring them the most money, but they want all the students.
But the other side of that, Senator Cho, is if the board feels that it's important to increase the number of teacher education majors at the master's level, or if it's important to increase the number of engineering students, the incentive that the board can direct right to the campuses,
sure,
an adequate base of funds to accomplish that task. In the old model, it was melding, and you tended to go down to the least possible cost on whatever your enrollment was. It's a movement from cost-driven to revenue-driven, and I think that's the big difference.
I might just also add that while you do attract that higher-level support, you also incur the significantly higher costs.
Mm-hmm.
In moving into engineering, it's not an accident that only about 4 institutions in Oregon, mm-hmm, public and private, have engineering. It's just incredibly expensive. Right. Far beyond these costs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question back to the previous slide. The various levels on this, level 1, 2, and 3, reflect what? Those are cost differentials?
Yes, that represents the state side funding. This is independent of the tuition. It's generated by those FTE students. If one goes back to the chart that was during Steve's presentation, the detailed 4-page chart, by level, all I've done is consolidated it down so that you could see it in a single frame. You really need 3 or 4 pages to see it in detail.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. There was a question raised about students and student funding. I want to make the point that what we're dealing with in the formula are the students that will be funded. But I think we need to come back to the question of how many students are likely to seek our services in the coming biennium. And I'd ask Susan Weeks if she could join us. And I believe in your packet, there's a blue day one follow-up in an effort to respond to the way that Susan is involved as the Director of Institutional Research Services in the Chancellor's Office, and she and her colleagues are the ones responsible for trying to make an estimate about enrollment demand, and she's going to run us through some.
Senator Courtney asked yesterday, help me understand the process.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Susan Weeks, for the record. I'm very pleased to respond to Senator Gordley's question about the basis for enrollment demand projection and the assumptions underlying our forecast. In your blue handout, there is, on the first page, a summary of the major assumptions underlying the projection, followed by 2 pages of somewhat excruciating detail about the methodology, the data, and the process by which we make our enrollment forecast. And I have been accused before of trying to explain how to build the clock when all you really want to know is the time, so I will try to just hit the very major point about the what underlies our enrollment demand projection. First, let me define what we mean by enrollment demand. The enrollment demand is the anticipated free flow enrollment resulting from the current demographic enrollment and academic program trends. It assumes a level of growth that is independent of our current budget request. It's an enrollment demand. It's the potential based on the trends that we see at work now. We estimate that by next year, fundable enrollment demand, the enrollment eligible for state support under the budget model will increase by about 5.6% at both the undergraduate and graduate levels. That's an increase of approximately 2,700 FTE, full-time equivalent students. The major factors are, first, that we anticipate more high school graduates, about 1,000 more statewide than in the previous year, class of 99, about 1,000 more. We also anticipate an increase in the freshman participation rates. That is the proportion, the number of freshmen enrolled in Oregon University System institutions out of the previous class of Oregon High School graduates. We would anticipate a demand of about 250 more freshmen over the past year. We've also been seeing improved retention at our campuses, especially in the first year. That's built into the demand projection. And there have been new scholarship programs aimed at keeping students in Oregon. Some of our other studies have shown that in the past, there were a number of students who left the state to attend college. We've seen a turnaround in that in the most recent data, and these efforts are aimed at keeping more of those students in Oregon. There are some other factors identified in the detail, but I won't go over those now. We do anticipate a slight drop in demand from the non-fundable students, primarily students from Asian countries and students from California, as California has been able to retain more of their own residents, and few of them are coming to Oregon institutions. Those are the major assumptions underlying our demand projection. If there are any questions about that, I'd be happy to respond.
Representative Jackson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just kind of wanted to editorialize. I think that historically, when many students went through a school, an OUS school, it was kind of a sink or swim proposition. There was not much attempt maybe generally made to keep that student or retain that student in school. And so I think this new funding model definitely will encourage everyone to, university people certainly to keep that student in school. And obviously, in the long run, that kind of benefits that student. So I think that's, from my point of view, an excellent thing to consider.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move along because Susan also has responsibility for the work that was that is underway in terms of the peer groups and the issue of trying to develop a set of peers that which Oregon universities would be measured against for on a number of things. These were not the peers that were used in making the model. I mean, they're close enough. We used some national data. We had a bigger sets at that time. But these are where it's narrowed down to now, and I'd ask Susan to describe it before I do.
Okay. Yesterday, Dr. Ashkenazi noted that higher education operates in a very competitive environment, and that's really at the heart of our efforts to develop the peer groups for the Oregon University System campuses. And although we based our selection peers on a great quantity of statistical data, one of the major principles that we followed in developing these peer groups was to balance the statistical data with the judgments of the presidents, provosts, and other campus staff. And this was all very much a collaborative effort. We developed our peer groups based on a set of selection criteria that characterized what we thought were the most important features of the environment. That included broad regional representation. That means that the institutions we selected needed to come from areas of the country that represented a broad spectrum of those areas. And I think we did that. The only exception is in the Northeast because most of those are smaller states. There's a very strong private college enrollment there, and so there are fewer there, but generally we have very broad regional representation. We wanted to select institutions from states that are similar to Oregon in population, economy, and geography, so that they would be states that would face some of the same issues and problems that we face here in providing higher education. We selected institutions that shared standard classification through the Carnegie classification scheme, which is a scheme that is based primarily on mission and program array in classifying institutions. So, for example, our large universities included peers from research and doctoral universities across the country. We selected on the basis of enrollment size, institutions that were similar in size and similar in the proportion of part-time versus full-time enrollment, institutions with similar degree levels, bachelor's, master's, or doctoral level programs, and the array of disciplines represented in those campuses. We looked at the ratio of research to instruction expenditures, and we also applied some individualized criteria to various institutions. For example, for Portland State, we looked at other urban institutions, and for Oregon State, other land grants, so that we tailored the list to those particular considerations. The next slide, slide 18, is a graphic display of the groups that resulted from our efforts. We developed individual lists for the three large universities, and from that, the campus presidents developed a common list for large universities, so all three of them, by drawing selected institutions from each of the individual lists, and those are represented in the middle under large universities' shared list. We also developed a regional university's shared list, or individual list, but the shared list was developed in collaboration with the presidents of the regional campuses. And because of OIT's specialized mission and array of programs, we have a single list for OIT tiers, and those are represented there as well. We think that the strength of our OUS peer group, as shown on slide 19, are that, as I mentioned, the selection criteria emphasize important aspects of the environment. These are the state population and economy, the university mission and programs, and enrollment characteristics. And secondly, the process allows the statistical data to inform qualitative judgment and vice versa. We wanted a nice balance between quantitative and qualitative information in developing these lists. And finally, these lists will allow us to support a variety of purposes, one being budget comparisons and further analysis within the context of the budget model, general trend analysis, and performance indicators.
What was the verification of these institutions? Was there a check on your selection?
Yes. We have, and I'd be happy to provide, a vast array of statistical data that looked at all of these institutions along several dimensions, enrollment, programs, degrees awarded, research, salaries, all kinds of things. And we applied a statistical process that would cluster these into close common groups. And that's how we started the process. Took the array of statistical data, worked with the presidents in whittling that down. Sometimes you get matches that look good quantitatively, but when you look at it, you know they make no sense because of the array of programs or some artifact in the statistical data. So we applied that qualitative judgment to make the list make more sense. But we did start with a very rich base of quantitative data.
Just a follow-up. So in essence, if you went and asked these peers, are you considered peers by your, I mean, I don't know if you did that, but would that be a reasonable assumption that they too would see them?
Yeah, yeah. And we have contacted our peers, and we are developing a network of relationships with our peer institutions so that we can easily get information from them.
We also use the National Association. Oregon State, for example, is a member of the National Association of Land Grant Colleges. We use that base. The University of Oregon is a member of the AAU. We use that base to see if you're similar with the Metropolitan University. I'm going to check with that.
And the other feature I think Susan mentioned was that we wanted regional representation. We didn't want everything clustered in one region. So that influenced that as well.
Thank you.
The other item I'd like to cover is the issue of performance. I mentioned it briefly in terms of using a part of this budgeting model to fund performance, but I'd like to call upon Dr. Nancy Goldschmidt, who's done a fair amount of work in terms of the area of performance and the so-called Oregon University System Report Card.
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nancy Goldschmidt, Senior Policy Associate in the Chancellor's Office. Yesterday, Dr. Ashkenazi and today, Mr. Ansel have both mentioned the importance that focusing on performance has been in the last 2 years since the implementation of Senate Bill 919. We could go on to the next slide. if we begin with what Oregon wants, and we think based on our research, at least in survey, that what they want is the very best in our public universities, and we follow that and we look at how we'll go about getting it, which is in the strategic plan of 2010 that was mentioned yesterday as well, and we come then to our four goals of quality, access, cost-effectiveness, and employable graduates. From these goals, we developed measures, eight measures, and about 29 indicators of performance. How is this different from what we've been doing before? If we look at slide 21, the report card that you have today, the performance report, half of the indicators emphasize results. That's the blue and white one. But we still have a few indicators that are measuring input the traditional way that educational organizations, whether they're higher education or K-12, has looked at itself. But we find that the access indicators, where all the input indicators are, these are inputs, kind of students that come in, our goals for higher achieving students, for increasing the numbers of students in high school participation, these are inputs. If you look at the process goals, one of the very important process goals that we were told to look into has to do with increasing internships. So the rest, though, are pretty much focusing on results. What does Oregon get by emphasizing results? And if you look at slide 22, you see that we want more Oregonians to obtain higher education. In this report, the degrees awarded increased by 5%. Broader program access, distance, time, and price has already been touched on yesterday and will be looked at more in the days to come. More students will complete degrees, graduates perform better on exit examinations, and more graduates will work in Oregon. Currently, recent graduate surveys say 3/4 of them stay in Oregon immediately in their first jobs, but the alumni that we look at, it says 61%. We'd like more of them to stay here. To begin work on the indicators, we collected 10-year trend data for those indicators for which we already had information. Some of these involved new data collection efforts, such as asking recent graduates how they rated the quality of the education they received. Susan Weeks mentioned the peer information. Campuses used the trend information to set improvement targets against themselves so they would be improving towards the year 2005. Next year, we will be using the peer groups to also set what I would like to call a stretch target to go even beyond comparing to what their past performance has been. In the report card, if I can show you, this is typical higher education. We have a stack of data, and I've tried to collapse this into something that you could, put in your suit pocket or something like that. So it's very abbreviated. Also, in your supporting documents, you have a yellow cover performance report that provides more detail, provides every year's worth of data. So you get a better look at that. I can give some examples, two examples of how this works. On slide 23, we want more students to finish degrees. For those students who started in 87 and finished by 93, 49% did. But currently, it's at 55%. By 2005, for those students who entered in 1999, we'd like that to be up to 58%. One of the critical things in bringing the graduation up rate higher is to ensure that students persist from their first year and beyond. For those who make it through the first year, 70% of them graduate. So that first year is very critical. A lot of the campus efforts are directed towards supporting students to make a successful transition into college and to come out with their degrees.
Okay. Do you know whether these are statistics within the university system itself? Do do we know if somebody, for instance, starts in the system and then graduates someplace else?
Okay, what we do know from these data here represents those students who start in the system and finish in the system, okay? So they could start at Portland State, finish at Southern, they could start at the University of Oregon and finish at the University of Oregon, and that would all be captured here. What is not captured is anybody who might leave the state to finish a degree or might go to a private institution within the state.
We just don't know that.
We don't know that. We have no way of tracking.
One more of them.
Yeah, so I would see that this would be a conservative number.
Part of my question was answered, which is, I guess, what contributes to students not going beyond the first year?
Okay.
What generally?
Several things contribute to that. A lot of the research has emphasized that the notion of a supportive learning environment, that students get connected with a group of students, with a group of peers, that they make connections with faculty, so it's very important that they are able to talk in class and get feedback on their work. These are things that we can have control over by designing and improving what goes on in the classroom.
So one of the things you might do under this model would be to try to freshman classes typically often in universities are pretty large.
That's
one of the things you would try to drive to try to.
That's true. Many of the campuses have initiatives in place, and perhaps the president will mention some of them, but to provide small student seminars. So freshmen do have several classes where there are only 20 students in them. They still do have some larger classes at some of the institutions, but in all cases, students do have opportunities for that interaction.
Representative Wilson?
Thank you. Along that same line, and I'll be happy to wait for that information that's coming up, you know, faculty obviously has to buy into this if student retention, especially the freshman year, is so important. So I'd like to know, as we go along, how faculty is buying into that and what faculty sees its role in making that happen.
Yeah. Okay,
thank you.
Representative
Day. Thank you, Chairman. Referencing specifically Representative Edwards' question, I taught for a long time, and I find that, or I found that a major reason I thought why a lot of kids are not successful is they got away from home for the first time, they were truly independent, and they didn't handle that very well. And I know that Senator Miller didn't have that problem. And I found that to be a problem, and I think the universities could address that and do connect, get those kids connected early on, because if they do get by that first year, then they tend to go on as you're indicating.
We'd like to have you meet three presidents. I think Representative Wilson has given us a marvelous segue in some of the comments.
Representative Lennon.
Actually, I was waiting to be able to ask you a question, Chancellor Cox, and it's regarding the sports action lottery. I appreciate the new funding model, given that it is more fair in its distribution, and I'm just curious why we don't adopt the same kind of distribution formula for the sports action lottery, so each university gets money from that based on it's per student per capita enrollment, as opposed to this.
My recollection is that there is a formula that in the statute that's called an active that is stretched out to students.
Actually, I have it here.
Follow that.
Chancellor. I just so happen to have that statute right in front of me. And actually, the only requirement in the statute is that 50% be made available for women's athletics. The others are, it says that the State Board of Higher Ed will give due consideration to the athletic conference to which the institution belongs and the relative cost to be in that conference, the level of effort being made by the institution to generate funds and support from private sources, give due consideration to. I mean, you can take that any one of a number of ways. Again, I'm just wondering why we don't at least adopt or attempt to adopt a more fair distribution formula than it that exists.
Well, I think our focus at this point is so much on the instructional applications of the model and being certain that we have put each of our institutions in a position to have a fair shot that we haven't gotten to some of the ancillary areas like athletics. You have three presidents coming who represent three different levels of athletic participation, and you can direct the question to them. But we have not extended it to the sports action lottery. It's just not been on the same screen.
Just to follow up, in my alma mater, Portland State, athletics is in fact one of the reasons a number of urban kids go to Portland State. It is just what draws them to the institution. And of course, as much support as we can give athletics means we get more oftentimes at-risk kids into college. I'd urge you to look at that.
Look it through. May I have you meet the three presidents? We'll begin with President Dan Hersey. I invite them all three at the same time, and Steve Rudolph from Southern Oregon holding down the center, and we'll close with President Kornheimer right here, willing to stay and respond to questions.
Chair Bennett, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Bernstein, and I'm the president of Portland State University. Before I begin, I'd just like to thank you for this opportunity to be here. This is my first full legislative session, and I hope that you won't hold any of my mistakes against me. It's been an exciting time at Portland State so far, and I really invite all of you to come to our university to see the great work that we're doing. I'd like to add a little bit to what Mr. Bender had said earlier when he spoke about our extended enrollment and the explanation for the increases that went to Portland State. Let me give you a few examples of this enrollment. These students are getting the same degrees. They often are taught by the same faculty as students in regular programs. And these are programs that Portland State has put in place primarily in response to the legislature, programs such as our statewide Masters in Social Work, the statewide MBA program, the degree completion program that we have at Schenectady, as well as the degree completion program not only on our campus, but also in Washington County. Under the old model, those credits that were generated were not credits that would be following the students and coming to the institution. Under the new model, those would be treated as credits following the students, and that those funds would then come to Portland State.
I'm sure. Yes. How many students are there in that category?
I guess it's hard to say, but several thousand. Yeah,
okay.
Students depend from year to year. I'll talk very briefly about Portland State and what the model means to my university, but I should tell you that I'm only giving you one story, and that is a story that each president could probably tell for his or her own institution. Portland State is a part of what we consider to be the pre-K through 16 continuum in the metropolitan region, and we're building on a tradition of partnerships, collaborations, and targeted investments in the region. Under the model, we have four major objectives. One is to serve more students. Second, to improve the quality of our programs. Third, to invest in programs that serve not only the state but also the metropolitan region, and also to restore the infrastructure on our campus. As I mentioned before, Portland State has a degree completion program at Temecula in early childhood education that allows students to take the first 2 years at the community college and then stay at the community college for completion of their last 2 years. We have several partnerships with K through 12 that connect our faculty and students to help enhance the capacity of the schools to deliver targeted programs. Examples of that would be our Urban Ecosystems Project, which provides hands-on learning experiences for students who are interested in math and
writing and analytical skills. Our freshman curriculum, the University Studies program, which has received nationwide recognition, has two cohorts, one at Grant High School in Portland and one at Westview High School in Beaverton. We also offer continuing education and in-service programs through our Graduate School of Education. We have co-admissions policies with both Mount Hood and Clackamas Community College, and depending upon the availability of resources, we plan to extend that co-admissions program to Portland Community College as well. We support the board's new budget resource allocation model and are already initiating changes in our programs and in our investment priorities in anticipation of the implementation of the new model. This year we will initiate a new incentive package that will reward departments and faculty for teaching more students. The Graduate School of Education will enroll a new cohort of students that want to be teachers, and we will also make limited investments in engineering and also and business degree programs in Washington County. We'll be doing these things and more beginning this fall. However, the improvement of Portland State depends upon the new model. As I said before, the model is critical as we move towards improving the quality of our programs as well as enrolling more students. That's a very brief synopsis of what the program means to Portland State, and I don't want to take up more time.
Thank you.
Not so much a question, but a comment. Many of us in Portland are very attached to our university there, and Dr. Bernstein's predecessor, Judith Mealy, when she left, a lot of us just were in angst, thinking that nobody could ever fill her shoes. I was actually on one of the interview committees at the Dr. Bernstein was on, and was just immediately impressed with him. And in the time since he's come to now, a lot of us have learned that he didn't need to fill Judith Romero's shoes. He brought his own shoes, and he's kind of eked out his own style, if you will. He is known for walking around campus, going up to shocked students and asking them how they're doing. And how the school is doing. He's become part of the Portland community, and we're just very proud to have him.
Chairman, Representative Lynn, thank you very much, Steve. Appreciate that.
Well, welcome, and we're happy to have you here. And as a long admirer and supporter of Portland State University, I appreciate what Representative Leonard has said. I think, however, for a newcomer, you're doing just fine to come in with the highest percentage rate increase in the new model. So I don't think you'll need any period of coaching or support having outdistanced everybody else.
Chairman, as Representative Ross, we try not to highlight that.
Chairman, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, for the record, I'm Steve Reno, the president of Southern Oregon University. And while we're on the subject of succession, I would like the record to show that I have been the president of Southern since 1994 and succeeded the gentleman who's now the chancellor of the university system, Joe Cox. I inherited big shoes and I'm doing my best. There is an awesome sense of responsibility in my sitting here today to represent the smaller institutions, and I want to draw a distinction, if I may, for a second, between the word we've often used in these discussions, that's regional universities, and smaller. There is a sense in which Western, Southern, Eastern, and OIT could be called regional institutions, and that is that we very much take our identity from our location, and we develop very close partnerships with the regions we serve. Western, of course, is in a very special place. It's located in the Willamette Valley. The rest of the three regionals are located outside of the Willamette Valley. And then OIT has a very specialized function and in terms of its range of programs. So I'm going to retreat to perhaps the smaller, rather a different word, and that is refer to us as the smaller universities in these discussions, and hope that I can speak fairly for that.
Well, I've given you, in a backward way, my 30-second geography lesson about the 30 colleges and universities in Oregon, public or private, and the fact that three of those of the public institutions are located outside of the valley. The flip side of that is to talk for a second about the history of our institutions, particularly over the last decade. And I'll just take Southern as an example of that, because I think it's important to the next point I want to make, which is to talk about the mission of our university. Since the first wave of budget cuts that were necessitated by the decline in state funding related to ballot measure 5 through to 1997, Southern has cut 10 of its academic programs. We have significantly reduced our staff, and we have curtailed many of our services. And I say that to you because that is something of a background for my making the point that to us and to the other smaller institutions, the new monies associated with the new model are very, very much needed to recapitalize our institutions. For our goal as smaller and in some cases regional institutions is to struggle to offer a full range of programs in the regions we serve and to develop appropriate partnerships with business, industry, professional associations, and others in those regions. And I just mentioned that Southern is very proud of the fact that it has nearly 150 very active partnerships in the region we serve now. And my colleagues from the other campuses could no doubt cite similar figures. So the impact of the resource allocation model, the new budget model, and the new monies we're asking for it on Southern as well as the others is certainly to challenge us to be entrepreneurial, to be competitive. And Steve and Bill Angelo and others are giving you an analysis of the principles of that new model and the risks that are entailed. We're ready to do this at Southern and at the other smaller campuses. We will in many ways, as a result of this new budget model, be acting like, behaving like private colleges do, particularly with the need for us to predict our enrollment and our revenue very, very precisely, because it will have an immediate impact on the operation of our institutions that year. No delays, but that very year. And to speak to a question that I think Representative Backlund asked a few minutes ago about faculty buy-in to this, I would just report from my campus, and again, the other presidents to do the same, that we have been working very closely with faculty and staff leadership on our campuses to explore what the real implications of this are. That admissions is no longer solely the function of the admissions office. That recruitment is everybody's business. Retention is everybody's business because it has a direct relationship to the nature of the institutions we have and the funding those institutions enjoy. And that, of course, is a lesson that our colleagues in the private institutions have known since the beginning of time. But it's a very steep curve, a steep rise in that understanding on our campus. So we're ready to be competitive, but we need to be appropriately capitalized to be competitive, particularly when you consider what we have been through over the past decade. We've made some very tough trade-offs on our campuses. I want to report to you that on February 13th, Southern had the first of its so-called preview days, where we invite prospective students, and often their families, to come to campus and look us over. And we had 425 visitors to our campus on February the 13th. They spent the whole day, some came the night before, looking us over. And this is true on all the campuses, but I just want to focus on Southern. I like those days because I spend a lot of my time just trying to be incognito to the extent a president can and kind of move among the prospective students and their parents, listening to them, finding out what they're looking for as they look our campus over. If you don't know this already, let me assure you that today's prospective students are very, very sharp shoppers. They're looking typically at three or four other institutions, often visiting them. They're coming to our campuses and they're asking tough questions. They're looking at technology on our campus. What's in the microcomputer lab? What's in the computer science department? What is in all of the other departments that a decade ago we never thought were as technologically dependent as they are today? They're looking at that. They're very, very sharp. They know what should be there. And if it's not, they vote with their feet, and they won't come back. I've mentioned before, and I'll just repeat it, and that is we're all familiar with the concept of deferred maintenance in buildings. When we don't fix a roof, when we put it off for a year or two. At our institution, and I believe it's true at the others as well, we've been engaged in a process for the last decade of what I call deferred sustenance. And I'll give you just an example. The chemistry department. So in 1991, when a long-standing faculty member in the chemistry department, a chemistry department of 12, a very fine department, with 100% placement of its graduates, retires, because of the budget cuts, we don't replace that person. And then in 1992, another person leaves, we don't replace that person. And we reconfigure the curriculum. Well, we don't buy that new piece of equipment we need for analysis in chemistry that year. We put that off. But then comes the next wave of budget cuts, and I think you get the picture. And just as you know, after a while, the roof leaks. After a very short period of time, you find that you have really struggled to keep your eye on quality while at the same time keeping your eye on your budget. These new monies will enable the smaller institutions to recapitalize and to begin to get back some of that ground. We can't cut the chemistry department at Southern Oregon University because we need chemistry to be offered in Southern Oregon at the undergraduate level. And so we look upon these monies as an opportunity for us to buy new instrumentation in an increasingly large number of departments that, as I say, a decade ago weren't as dependent on technology as they are now, to restore positions to departments where we have had to cut positions over the last decade. What will the state of Oregon get from these new investments? I just cite a couple. Internships for our students so that they go out after graduation into the world of work prepared by having had a real-world experience while they're still undergraduate. Loaned faculty programs, so we can keep our faculty current by having them out in the community, particularly during summertime. An increase in the number of students coming out of our graduates coming out of our teacher ed program and from our computer science program. I mentioned last week, and I'll just repeat it, and then I'll close with this. I've been thinking about the word average and the fact that there are very few times when we're really satisfied with that. I just had a physical last week, and I was delighted to learn that my cholesterol, my blood pressure, my pulse, and my weight are average. That's great. But that's about all I can think of right now where I'm happy with average. And I would simply make the point that when prospective students are looking at our campuses, average isn't good enough. Average isn't competitive. And that's what we see an opportunity with this new budget model and this new funding to redress. So I'll stop there, and thank you.
I'd like to say some nice things about President Reno, too, especially if you could get a couple of incompletes off of my transcript in the fall of 1970.
I'm not going to check that if I may, sir.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Dave Fonmeyer, President of the University of Oregon, and appellate lawyer as I am, may I ask how much time I have remaining, Your Honor?
Our session starts at 10:30 and 10:45.
All right. Madam Chair, I will try to be brief, and it's very difficult to follow much of what has preceded me. Today and in coming days, you've heard much about models, statistics, burdens, methodologies, performance measures, all of which are terribly important, and we're crucially invested in them. But I thought I would close, if I may, briefly by why it matters. I'd like to discuss why higher education matters and why I or you should care. Nearly 150 years ago in the Oregon Admission Act, only about three things that are really substantive were required by the Congress. And one of them was higher education, the establishment of a public university. It was a promise that was made by Oregon to the Federal Union more than 150 years ago. And I think that's very significant because we've reached another threshold today, and that's whether we're going to thrive in the 21st century with a citizenry educated K through 16 or as high as they can go, or whether we're going to be the economic colony of others who've made those investments and done so more efficiently. Several weeks ago, I had an op-ed column in the Oregonian urging support for the full continuum of education. And last week, that was responded to by a polite letter, but one that was critical, and I'll quote from it very directly. This author says only one in four jobs in our economy requires a college degree. The other three-fourths do not and will not in the future. That is not an adequate rebuttal. That is tragically wrong. And if there's anyone in this room that holds that assumption, I urge you to be disabused of it. The governor's educational policy advisor is in this room, and he would tell you the same thing. Over the last decade, Oregon companies created 100,000 new professional jobs. Almost every single one of them required a college degree. Right now, not only a quarter, but 29% of Oregonians have a college degree, and the projection is that we'll need to increase that number very dramatically if we're going to stay competitive as a state or a region. Almost all of the increase in educational levels through a baccalaureate degree in the last decade has come not from Oregon educating its own, but from in-migrants. And if we want to have that kind of society, we are reneging on our promise in the Oregon Admissions Act. So why does it matter? It matters because of the people who are with me today. By happy accident and not by design, I have with me Alexis Yabugwe, who was selected by random to be the shadow of the president. I will be her shadow, attending, and I hope not called on, in her upper division course in Latin American history in just a few hours. And I just met her this morning because of this lottery. But I will tell you that she is a graduate of Grant High School from Northeast Portland. I will tell you that she won a national photography contest sponsored by the Oregonian and Parade magazine before she graduated from high school. This is not her first appearance at the state capitol. She was a Rose Festival princess when she visited here in 1997. She's a major in theater arts, and she hopes to have a fine career ahead of her. In the back of the room, I'd ask them just to stand, and I can't even name them, are presidential scholars from the University of Oregon. They're from West Lynn, Beaverton, South Salem, Marist High School, St. Mary's in Medford. They're presidential scholars. They probably would not be able to attend college, or many of them might have chosen to go elsewhere, but for private philanthropy, not because the state is supporting their education. They're a living testament to the real faces that are at issue behind these methodologies, behind these statistics, behind these facts that we're bringing to you. The 5 points that I want to leave to you in the remaining 90 seconds that I have, and I believe I can touch on them all. The first is that we have to stop the brain drain, that we can demonstrate through those cold statistics affected Oregon from the passage of Measure 5 on. Because of our best and brightest leave, they won't come back. At least 60% of them won't come back, and we'll be importing brains rather than educating our own. Second, we need to stop the horrific burden of debt that college creates for so many of our young people. Our tuition increase strategies, frankly, have run their course. We supported the system and backfilled the loss of general fund revenues by an 80% tuition increase over 6 years. That has run its course. It's affected our students, their motivation, their capability of conducting the careers that they want to through the course of their lifetimes. And frankly, the out-of-state tuition strategy that probably brought $50 million into the system has also run its course. California has actually lowered its tuition and increased its capacity for its students, so that source of revenue no longer exists for us. The third point has been touched on by my colleagues. We have to attract and support the best faculty and keep up with the maintenance of our buildings. Our faculty generally is at between 85 and 90% of their comparators in the other institutions, and believe me, those other institutions know it, and they're rating it. And all we need is to have a brain drain of our faculty, and we'll see our investment in human capital go straight down the drain. The fourth, and it's directly responsive to several questions that have been asked, is that we have to change for the future. We know that this student-centered model enables us to do that. We know the critical need to retain students between the freshman and sophomore year. These same students who are with me today, many of them are in honors programs, where they have small classes right from the very first time they enter the University of Oregon or any of our institutions. They have mentoring by faculty who care deeply about their success, and that the student-centered entrepreneurial model means that we all have a stake in making sure that our students stay with us. And finally, we have to ready ourselves for the wave of new students. By every demographic index that we know, that wave of students is going to increase. And if school reform is even modestly successful, as I believe that it will be, the percentage of students who will go on from high school to college, which is already 61% in Oregon, not the 25% that this writer of a letter to the editor wrote, that percentage is only going to increase. We have not been investing in the physical plant, in the infrastructure, in the human capital to address that. And that's what we have to do with a model such as this kind. We have to do it at a way in which, in the increase of that market share, we're also competitive. More than a century ago, a promise was made that if a person had merit, cared, worked hard, the that they have a chance at higher education regardless of how rich they were. Oregon joined that group of states that said higher education wasn't just a promise for a tiny elite, but something that was a promise of public support that would keep the barriers down for everyone. In the beginning, tuition was free in Oregon. Until this decade, it was low enough to enable students to afford easily what they could do. For a time during this decade, I thought that Oregon was breaking its promise of the Admission Act and the more implicit promise that a public institution ought to make. But more than any other legislative assembly in recent memory, I believe you are aware of this promise and that you possess the fortitude to keep it. These are the faces for whom it makes a difference. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Chair Gordon.
Madam Chair, just a couple of comments to all three presidents. First of all, I think our state is blessed, richly blessed, to have this quality of remarkable leadership. And thank you all for your presentations today. And I agree with President Sonmeyer that I think this legislature is keenly aware of the challenges in front of us. I think you've outlined them, you've all outlined them very clearly. The other thing I would, just a couple of other comments. President Sonmeyer, at your university, there is the Pacific Program, or sponsorship of the Pacific Program. Former State Representative Carl Hostica has a coordinating role in this program, as I understand it. And I would just like to urge continuation of the university's support for the Pacific Program. It's a fine program. I had the opportunity to be the first legislator to go through it this past October, and would like to see more legislators benefit from what is a remarkable leadership training opportunity for public servants. Just want to get that pitch in. And to my president, Dan Bernstein, I'm still working on completing my PSU uniform. I thank you for the button. I now need a sweatshirt. If Debbie Murdoch will come up to my office, I'll give you a check.
Better bring two. We'll take yours.
And to Alexis, remarkably gifted, talented student, it's a pleasure to see you here this morning and to know that you are shadowing President Sonmeyer. I'd like to invite you to join me on the Senate floor if you have time to do that during our session this morning. Grant High School is one of the schools in my district. Would also invite you up to my office. We have photography in common. And we'd just like to have the opportunity to chat with you at some point during the day. And to the other students, we commend you and applaud all of your achievements. And while you're in the Capitol today, please give some thought to your future public service and the fact that down the road, you may be called upon to serve in your state legislature. That's one of the opportunities that is in front of you, and particularly for the young women. We need more women in government, and we need more women legislators. So just want to share those thoughts as parting comments. And again, thank you all for your support.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I would be delighted to spare Alexis for 1 hour, but her class starts at 12:30, so after that hour, I don't want to be responsible.
If I could just add, not only is Grant High School in Senator Gordley's district, it is one of the greatest high schools in the state. So, slightly modestly.
I think there are wonders in the idea of random choice.
Well, thank you for coming. It's a great presentation and encouragement.
Thank you.